This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. There are well-documented racial disparities in health outcomes in the United States. African Americans are 40 to 60% more likely than whites to get chronic illnesses like heart disease and diabetes. And the social realities in communities of color are big factors in those health outcomes. Perhaps the most prominent minority health crisis right now is playing out in Flint, Michigan, a majority African-American city where at least 8,000 children have been exposed to unsafe levels of lead in the water supply. For advocates of social justice, the Flint water scandal is just one of many instances in which their work intersects with public health. Those ties between social justice and public health are the theme for this year's Minority Health Conference at UNC Chapel Hill. Crystal Lee Crane is one of the keynote speakers at this year's event. She's an activist and political science and sociology professor at institutions in California and Michigan. Crystal Lee, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you.
Also with us is Anna Dardick. She is a master's candidate at UNC Chapel Hill's Gilling School of Global Public Health and co-chair of this year's Minority Health Conference. Anna, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank.
Crystal Lee, I was just talking about Flint as an example of social justice and public health, where they meet. Can you give us a broader scope of sort of how these two come together?
Yeah, well, I'm originally from Flint, Michigan. Was born there in the 80s and saw the economic disinvestment from the auto industry that really happened about the end of the 1970s. And so I grew up watching a city that was once vibrant, with businesses, with jobs. We had our own universities. We still do. And we were seeing people moving out. We were seeing the city shrinking because the opportunities are being taken away. Whether we had our factories being, put overseas, we're manufacturing with them being put on countries and other places around the world that had lower employment and labor laws. And then we also saw just a complete removal of our democratic rights, most recently under the leadership of Governor Rick Snyder, which placed emergency managers in different cities throughout Flint, majority black cities around Michigan and in Flint, Michigan in particular. That emergency manager appointment led to the water crisis.
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the key issues that, and maybe you can tell me, but it seems that this question of enfranchisement, power and the power relations, the ability to have a voice in your community is central. It's not just the economic conditions, but perhaps as important as whether or not you have control. And you just talked about taking control of the school system away from the mayor, efforts to restrict the vote in states across the country. All of these have an impact on how much say you have over your own water supply and other health factors. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I would say the water supply. I would say, a lot of folks, I have a lot of families that are still back there, and everyone's really thankful for the attention that our city's been given. The worry is that once there appears to be a reasonable solution presented, then everyone will look elsewhere. And not that Flint is the only place that needs to be examined. But unfortunately, the Republican Party and many other conservative or moderate Democrats are looking at these emergency manager laws as a way to, they're saying, fix budgetary concerns. So instead of providing the constitutional right for the access to vote for folks, they are saying, yes, you can vote. And we can have these people in office, but they're not going to have any power to do anything. This emergency manager that will be appointed by the governor, who may not even be from your city, is going to be the one in charge of administering your resources. So it's water, it's education, it's food, it's land, how land is being distributed. It's a number of things.
Well, Anna, from a public health perspective, we've seen these kind of disparities. You've seen these kind of disparities play out in your own research. Again, give us some scope about sort of how these disparities play out in other instances across the country.
Right, Frank. That's a great question. So these disparities play out in a bunch of different fields, even from the beginning of someone's life. African-American women are much less likely to carry a baby to term, and these aren't individual problems. They're systemic. a lot of what public health does is preventative. And I think that the most preventative work that you can do is justice work, because systems are at the basis of all of these really huge problems, systems like poverty, unequal education, and racism.
And, you know, we can talk about, as we did, as Crystal Lee was talking about, sort of power and the ability to vote and have control over your own community, economic systems, economic injustice. But then there are sort of historic reasons, about trust and whether or not one community trusts another. I guess the Tuskegee syphilis experiment plays a big part in this. It's historic and, again, something we don't always think about. But do those things still play a role in what we're seeing play out today?
Absolutely. Those things definitely play a role. I think that the public health community has to look critically at our own work and ask how our work may perpetuate the problems that we're trying to solve. And that's so the conference, the Minority Health Conference, which is coming up on February 26th. The theme is in solidarity, the role of public health in social justice. And social justice offers public health a set of principles to guide our work. As public health professionals and advocates, we can look to social justice principles and look to social justice practitioners to learn and deepen our commitment to eliminating social and institutional factors. We can learn that from social justice. And I think we have to. As you mentioned with Tuskegee, that's the most famous example, perhaps, but not the only example of public health work that actually creates these institutional problems rather than alleviating them.
Well, Crystal Lee, one of the themes of the conversation or this conversation is allocating resources correctly. How do you think we approach that problem? I mean, how does it show up nationally in ways that haven't grabbed the headlines the way Flint does, but are playing out every day in cities and rural areas across the country?
You know, I talk about this often with my students, and, you know, a number of my students are undocumented, and they always say, you know, I'm paying taxes, but I don't get even a say on where that goes. And then my students who are not undocumented and have at least a few generations in this country, you know, feel the same way. And they're saying, you know, Ms. Crane, how do we find out? And then I teach them how to do the Freedom of Information Act request, but that does not get them the information that they want. They want to know, am I paying enough for our education? Am I paying enough to make sure that we have, you know, proper streets to drive on or sidewalks to walk on? And that information is not transparent. What I think should be happening is a much more democratic budgeting process, to where the people themselves present their proposal, essentially, to city, county, state, and federal government, and say, this is where we'd like our money to go, and it's your job to get as close to that as you can.
Well, you know, what? Go ahead. Finish that.
I know what I was going to say, and I think that if that was to happen, you know, that's a direct way for our elected officials to be held accountable.
Well, right? Well, one of the things we're hearing from those who have the privilege to serve as elected officials is that this is less a social justice issue and more a budgetary issue. The reason we deny Medicaid benefits to 500,000 North Carolinians here was because we wanted to get our financial house in order. The reason that we, don't deny unemployment benefits is because it'll cost too much. So these things are not debated in legislatures and in Congress as social justice issues, but rather budgetary issues. I mean, Crystal Lee, I'll start with you. How do you respond to that? It seems like you've got a sort of asymmetries there in terms of where the conversation should even begin.
I think it's a cop-out to divide social and fiscal concerns. Oftentimes people will say, I'm socially liberal and I'm fiscally conservative. And these kind of, you know, I'm this or I'm that, I'm on one side or the other, doesn't allow folks to see the experiences that we have at the intersections of race, gender, sexuality, relationship to the state itself, you know, heritage, do we belong to an indigenous community? All of these questions are part of, I think, the budgetary conversation. And folks are uncomfortable with having them, I think, oftentimes because it doesn't allow them to have control over the conversation, because then they're actually going to have to ask us what it looks like for us.
Anna, I know that this conference is directed in large part to practitioners and to people in the social justice and medical fields, and not necessarily the public. Tell us sort of what the frame and the focus of this conference is.
Right. So I already mentioned the theme, but really the focus of the conference is that public health practitioners have something to learn from social justice work about creative solutions, about listening and working with communities, and also that public health practitioners have something to offer justice work. We have skills, we have grants, we have, and we have connections. And I think that the two sort of fields can work together to really make change. I often think that if social justice and public health were a Venn diagram, they'd be as close to a circle as you can get.
That said, Crystal Lee, for instance, there's a great debate about whether or not we should consider guns in America a public health issue. And it is a debate, and it is a political debate, despite the amount of mayhem, death, and destruction that guns cause in America compared to any other developed country on the earth. So is a conversation, where should we be having this conversation, and why is it so difficult to sort of bring these two worlds together, do you think, in the public sphere? Crystal Lee?
Mm-hmm. I think in the public sphere, you know, many folks are uneducated about the political process. And although I was pointing to voting as being a way to politically participate, there's a lot of other ways to participate. And oftentimes the lack of funding in our public education system directly leads to a subset of the population that does not understand their personal or political agency and what they can do with their experiences and their time and their energy. And I think that lack of education directly affects this kind of movement that we're seeing.
One of the sessions at this year's conference is about the role of social justice and higher education. Crystal Lee, what role do you think you as an academic have in social justice, and what does that mean for improving public health?
Yeah, so I teach at both community colleges, university level and graduate school levels, and I really enjoy teaching at community colleges because, you know, I feel like I'm able to reduce some of the gaps that public education has left with so many young people coming out of schools. Many of them, you know, especially, you know, I live part-time in Oakland, part-time in Flint, and in Oakland here, you know, we have some high schools with a 50% graduation rate. The rest of the students may or may not get their GED, but with the community colleges here, it's open access to everyone. And then we have students coming in, some who can read, some who can't, some who, you know, have a hard time coming up with their own opinion because nobody asked them, right, in K-12, and they were just talked to and talked at rather than talked with. And learning with their instructor and their peers. I think another major issue is the way that, you know, there is a huge crunch on curriculum happening nationwide where programs are being shrunk down to the most minimalistic approach for the topic. And a big piece of that, you know, is around creating a much more conservative lens, whether it's the study of English language or political science. And here in the state of California, there's been just a battle of trying to keep classes about race on the docket. And some folks don't think that that's necessary, that's extra. And this either, you know, and this is supposed to be, you know, the progressive West. But these are just some of the things that are coming up for my students, you know.
Well, much of your work today has to do with juvenile justice and the criminal justice system at large. Mm-hmm. You're on a commission in Alameda County to prevent juvenile delinquency. I think we're maybe still using that term. I don't know. But in any case, it's a prevention program. What kinds of preventions are working there in Alameda County?
Yeah, so I'm a judicial appointee for the Alameda County Commission on Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. And this came out of the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act almost 10 years ago. And so specifically, most counties are supposed to have a commission, and we are charged with oversight over the police departments that have holding facilities for young people, group homes within the county, and the juvenile justice center, juvenile hall, and the lower offender, nonviolent young people go to Camp Sweeney. What we're really looking to do is to create programs at the intersection. So I've been really working to get college classes actually taught inside juvenile hall to the young men who are still waiting after they've graduated to be either released or placed into an adult facility. Unfortunately, many young people are being charged as adults, and so we see 16, 17-year-olds given 30-year sentences. And while they're waiting to turn 18 and sometimes 21, you know, they're with us on the county level. And so there's all this time that's wasted, not only with their incarceration, but on top of that, you know, once they're done with high school, the system doesn't know how to necessarily respond. So what if they have access to college before they go to an adult facility, and that can show good behavior and potentially they'll be able to get released sooner? You know, I'm trying to think of all of these ways within the system that we can work at the intersections, but then also on the outside, you know, how do we politically educate people so that we're not economically and socially responding to one another in a way that criminalizes our neighbor and allows folks to be incarcerated inside systems and prisons that have very little oversight on what they do to people in there. And then lastly, you know, the ways in which we don't see ourselves as those folks in prison.
Weird.
And I think that's a big gap. And that's, you know, the unfortunate success of the war on drugs.
We are talking about minority health disparities today on The State of Things. Krista Lee Crane is a political science and sociology professor and a keynote speaker at a minority health conference coming up at UNC Chapel Hill. And Anna Dardick is also with me, a master's candidate at UNC Chapel Hill. Anna was talking about bringing health practitioners and showing them what they can learn from social justice techniques and folks in the world of social justice to see what the medical world and health public health world have together. How do you see that going forward? How do you see that actually playing out? A conference like this, bringing these two worlds of professionals together, how does that play out in terms of bringing change in any of the systems that we've described today?
I really think that, you know, we need to start building stronger coalitions that are local and regional, but also then have national support so that we're responding on a larger scale with local, you know, prowess. Because even if the emergency manager laws, for example, to use that, are happening in, you know, let's say Wisconsin and Ohio, Michigan, it's coming to the South and it's coming to the West Coast if we don't organize and prepare for it. And, you know, these are ways that we can share strategies. These are ways that we can share, you know, leadership development and political education strategies, but then also looking at systems, what is there, and then how do we need to reform and or start over and build something else that's going to be stronger and be able to hold the population increase, right, that we have in this country. And, you know, I was trying to explain to my students the other day that when, you know, things like the Constitution and other doctrines of this country were created, we were a much smaller mass of people. We did not have technology. It was a different time and a different place. And we're still living in that old time and old place systemically. And the ways that we're trying to build on progress aren't sticking because the system won't allow it.
I want to thank you both for being on the program today. Krista Lee Crane is an activist, a political science and sociology professor, and one of the keynote speakers at this year's Minority Health Conference at UNC Chapel Hill. Her lecture is going to be available via webcast on February 26th, and you can find out how to do all that and register at our website, stateofthings.org. Krista Lee, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Anna Dardick is a master's candidate at UNC Chapel Hill's Gilling School of Global Public Health. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, we're going to get a preview of the North Carolina Comedy Arts Festival, which has become the largest in the Southeast. We'll find out why in a moment on The State of Things. Stay with us.